Hello, I'm Justin from TED Learning. Welcome to this podcast on wellbeing in the workplace. I'm delighted to be joined by Claire Morton, who's one of the UK's most sought-after wellbeing consultants, as well as a number one best-selling author, and her business partner, Jules Kelly, who moved into the wellbeing space after suffering burnout herself. Both are multiple award winners with over 20 years of consulting experience in the private and public sector, and experts in meditation, mindfulness, emotional intelligence, and wellbeing care. Claire is a fully qualified yoga teacher alongside her work as a practitioner and leadership development specialist. Jules is a holistic leadership and success consultant who shares her journey via the Life Freedom Method. Claire, Jules, thank you for joining us on this podcast. So why do you two think that well-being in the workplace is an important thing? Why is it a passion of yours?
So for me, well-being has been a passion of mine outside of the workplace for a long time. And working in HR over the years and in learning and development, it's always became a part of that department in an organization. So I always used to say, oh yeah, bring it to me. I want to help with that. And I think a lot of businesses see, and I think we might go on to talk about this in a while, they see well-being as having a few yoga classes or having like a fruit bowl in reception or, you know, at the end of the desk for teams. And it's obviously more than that. So for both of, you know, Jules and I, we are really, really passionate about taking well-being into the workplace so that corporations and organisations see it as it's not just about doing something small in work. It's a whole lifestyle choice. And it's about having like a well-being strategy, like you do have a marketing strategy or a sales strategy or a business strategy. It should run alongside that. But for me, the passion comes from I left the corporate world 7 years ago to set up my own training business, but because I was so burnt out and I was so disengaged and I had nothing left to give. So that was where it's really come forward to me. It was 7 years ago. I was 40 years of age. I'm now 47. And I now know how to live a life of balance. And it's took me that long to do that. And we want to be able to educate people to understand what a balance is and how to live well and joyfully from an earlier stage onwards. Because at the minute, the whole world is on a treadmill of just, we need to do stuff all the time. And we actually don't. It's questioning when we do need to rest and when and what we're doing is actually something that we enjoy doing. Because a lot of us do stuff that we just should do as opposed to what we want to do.
Like Claire, Justin, I also had burnout. I had literally had a complete breakdown, physical and mental breakdown in 2017. And whilst I was driven to work really, really hard, and that comes through, I found out at 47, not before. It comes back that all it stems from our belief systems, and our belief systems start obviously from the minute we're born. Like 0 to 7 is really important age for beliefs, and then 7 to 14 and onwards. And what I learned as I was getting well was that I was almost conditioned to work myself into the ground based on past experiences and past beliefs that I had created. And had I not had that, then invariably my life would be completely different. So my passion comes from helping people learn from my mistakes, from and Claire's mistakes. And I worked in the corporate world and I had my own business. And when in 2017, I was managing director of a care company that employed lots and lots of people in the health industry, but actually well-being for the staff team wasn't necessarily a priority. It was almost tick boxes that we had to comply with for certain rules and regulations, rather than actually, whilst we would be considered the employers of choice and we did things to support our employees. If I think back to, was there a wellness program? No, there wasn't. if there was, and I'd been heading it, would I have had that hitting the wall moment? Probably not. And we see it now in society that there's a lot of talk about quiet quitting going on, and people now, especially after the pandemic, people now are really assessing life and almost their mortality and thinking, right, well, what is it that I want from life? So what Sarah and I are passionate about is helping people to embrace all of life. But we spend so much time at work, then we can't just think wellness in the time that we've got at home. It has to be a holistic approach. And to do that, to bring the employers on board and the leaders of the employers, obviously, if we can teach them to lead by example, then it filters down. And it doesn't just filter down to their employees. It then filters down to the children of those employees if they've got them. And then we influence the next generation.
I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with you. I mean, having worked in corporate as well, you can kind of feel that burnout of working those sort of 12, 13 hour days. Quite often, though, when we talk to companies about well-being, you'll get those that really embrace it. And then you'll get some, and Claire sort of alluded to this point earlier, of saying, well, it's just things like yoga and some fruit. And actually, if people want to look after their well-being, that's out of work. How do you respond to companies that have that mindset?
Well, there's a lot of stats out there that show, especially there's a Deloitte, I think, and Gallup have done some good reports on well-being and recognition at the minute. And there's a figure going about saying for every pound you invest in well-being for your staff, the return on investment is around £5 back. And also for the point of, I think 70% of doctors' visits are down to stress. So if we can then help and educate our employees to be less stressed, to be able to manage their own well-being in a way that it's a holistic thing, because I think people think of wellness as, you know, go in the gym, yoga, the fruit bowl. When you look, what we first do is we'll educate the organization on what well-being actually is, because it's physical well-being, it's mental well-being, it's financial well-being, because people are really stressed about money at the minute. It's your community as well, about where are you in the community with your teams, or what voluntary work do you do, because it's that sense of belonging. And then it's also around the social aspect of things. So if we can look and teach organizations to look at well-being as a whole, it's not just about wellness. Wellness is one small part. Well-being is all aspects of life for individuals. And if we can teach organizations how to touch each of those touch points. So if people are stressed about finances, what are we doing to educate them on finances and how to manage money better? Or it's also what do they love to do? What are the people, what are they passionate about, and giving them roles that they're passionate in, rather than what necessarily, oh, well, this is your role. Just you're given that role. And even though you might not be good at it, because well, how are they going to, they might feel forced into it. So you know as well as I do that when you're working in corporate, if you're good at the day job, you usually then get given a manager's or a leadership position. And not everyone wants to do that, but that seems to be the next step that you're conditioned to do. Some people will thrive with that, some people won't. And then that can then lead to burnout. So again, I was looking at some notes the other day, and I've got the notes here. It says, the cost of voluntary turnover due to burnout is around 15 to 20% of the payroll budget each year. So if businesses are looking at the bottom line, the way to invest in staff is definitely in a well-being strategy, and definitely in wanting to keep and retain those staff, because it'll make you more productive, you will be able to perform better, and you'll have more engaged staff, and the staff will and the teams will be resilient in what they're doing and what they're delivering, because they'll be more happy, because they are more balanced and they are well. So it's like a whole lifestyle thing for me.
Completely holistic. And one of the things that we will ask our corporate clients is, what is your sickness rate? What are your challenges? How are your team performing against? What are you measuring them against? How much are you spending on sickness? How much is that costing your organization? And how much are you actually investing in well-being? Because there's a direct link there. So, for example, I'm not going to mention the names, but they're basically public purse organizations. And massive sickness challenges. And I think 10% of the payroll is almost at the annual cost. And there's a general route to go down an occupational health route, but there's no real measurement on how that occupational health delivery then impacts on the return to work, etc. Because it's almost a tick box route. It's almost the route that is expected. And so what Claire and I are doing is almost, we're almost disrupting the process, because we will challenge, and we're not doing down occupational health, but we've been using that for so long. Right, when are we going to change? When are we going to change it up? So actually, yes, this is the cost of sickness. You're sending them down this occupational health route. How much of that is that coming back? Is it affecting your performance? Is it improving your performance? Or is it actually just a tick box that actually ends up managing somebody out of the organization through a sickness route? Depending on the type of person you are, I was told a million times that I was heading for burnout. There was no way on God's earth that I would listen to that. Don't be ridiculous. Why would you think that? You know, for capable, busy people, they don't often listen. So ultimately, I didn't listen until I had to, which is, for me, I ended up bedbound. I ended up very sick. I had a chronic health condition. I had a chronic pain condition called fibromyalgia. And it stopped me completely in my tracks. How would I have acknowledged it before is almost listening into the body. Things start to go wrong. Things start to stop working as they should. Feeling of overwhelm, feeling of having to juggle all of the things, and almost knowing that you are not sleeping well, you are not switching off, you're not exercising, you're not getting into fresh air, you're not having any balance. So how would we resolve that is to stop and do a life audit.
Can I just ask you with that, Jules? And for me, I very much similar to you with the burnout symptoms. And one of mine was that lack of clarity and the brain fog and just not being able to think straight because you've got that many things going on in the head. And then to numb that down and to slow that down, I started to drink more to just quieten the head. Because this is obviously before I discovered yoga and meditation. And it was like, just crack on again the next day. And then it could possibly be for me that I'd be like a bottle of wine every night just to, that was the way of relaxing. And then that is also not good for the body or the mind or the soul. But you just get into that spiral.
And then that spirals on because the next day you feel awful. So you just carb load and then you feel heavy, you feel sluggish, you feel more tired. And then you don't plan, you don't prep, you're literally flying by the seat of your pants the whole time. So if you are finding yourself eating a load of convenience food, if you're finding yourself drinking, self-medicating, having headaches, being dehydrated, having pains in the body, not being able to think straight, being sad, being overwhelmed, being angry, being frustrated, all of these signs are signs that you are completely out of alignment.
Yeah.
And by understanding yourself better isn't a quick fix. We're not suggesting here's a tablet and it's all going to go well. It's about stopping and taking complete ownership of this human suit that we live in, because it's where we live from the minute we wake up, the minute we're born to the minute we drop dead. And when we say, oh my God, I've got this is happening to me. No, your body is doing the best that they can under everything that you're putting them through. That's the fact. And when we start to look after our body as we would our home or our car or all of the things that matter to us, and we make that a priority, we will start to make better decisions.
And, you know, some of the stuff you've talked about, you've mentioned sort of yoga and meditation. You know, some people listening to this podcast, that just might not be the thing for them. You know, I've tried meditation and I've struggled with it, but there are other things that I know that you suggest and support with that people might go, yeah, I can do that. So what other things can people do to take care of their well-being?
The first thing as part of our Life Freedom Method is, do you drink 2 litres of water a day? Because your body, if you think of your body like almost like a machine, it needs flushing through. Body is, water is life. So people will have no problem drinking a bottle of wine, but drinking a bottle of water is a step too far. So it's these little things, right? So we start off with the water, then we look at nutrition, we look at whether we're eating properly, we look at just getting out in nature. Like this morning, I make sure I get up earlier to go and walk my dogs, because I know I'm going to have a day at my desk. I do an hour exercise in the morning, and I'm not a gym bunny. Claire will go into the gym and do classes and all the rest of it. That makes me feel physically sick, but actually walking in nature is massively therapeutic. It's good for you. You've got fresh air, you've got nature, and nature has been proved to help with mental and physical well-being.
Also that time with the dogs, because we're all dog lovers on here, aren't we? So that being with the dogs and animals can really help. So that time for me in the morning with the huskies before I go to the gym is huge.
But it's about finding something that works for you, isn't it? Because I know when I was talking to Claire before we doing this podcast today, and I said that one of the things that I was doing again was getting up early and going for a run each morning. And that feels good. And your question back to me was, do you actually enjoy it though? And I said to you, yes, I do. And you was like, well, that's great then. And I think, you know, your point, Jules, of getting out and sort of spending time in nature, and absolutely as a dog lover myself, spending time with my pets is something that motivates me and makes me excited for the day. But for some people, that might feel quite difficult for them to do that. So how do you get people's mindsets to shift to say, I need to do something about it? Because I went through a period towards the end of last year where I had a million and one reasons not to look after my well-being. I was tired in the morning, so when my alarm went off and I wanted to get up for a run, it was cold, it was too early, it was dark because it was winter, so I didn't do it. And I spiraled into that kind of eating. Drink's never been a thing for me, but it's been comfort food. How do people get out of that and start taking care of themselves?
The first thing that we ask our clients is, how badly do you want to get better? How badly do you want to feel better? Because they say, God, we'll do anything. And they go, okay, so what are you prepared to do to make that happen? And when they say anything, then we'll challenge that. Okay, well, we'll do anything then. So what's important for us is to teach people that we're not all the same. Mm-hmm. And actually it's important that whatever we allow into our space is something that lights us up, that we enjoy. So Claire and I work with a system called Human Design as well. And Human Design works on the premise that we don't all have to be all of the things. We have a role to play in our life on this planet. And it's not all about work, and it's not all about, it's a whole holistic journey, and what works for some people doesn't necessarily work for others. So actually comparisonitis is the thief of joy, right? So we don't compare. So Claire gets up at daft o'clock in the morning and goes to the gym, and I'm quite happy sitting in my bed while she's doing that with a cup of tea. Just have, you know, you could journal, you could do all of these different things. So the first question is, how badly do you want to feel better? And if it's really badly, you could say, right, well, what are you prepared to do for it? I would love to be a dress size smaller. It's not important enough for me to do something radical about it, right? So I can say it all day long, but if I don't do anything about it, it doesn't, for me, it means that it's not that important. So when I got sick, I wanted to get well. And so I would do literally anything. And I did all of the things that I needed to do to get well. But there are people that don't want that. And they don't necessarily know why. And by suggesting that they don't want it, might trigger them. But that's where the deep work comes in. It's always why. Maybe it's not safe to be well. Maybe it's not safe to be active. But maybe past experiences have meant that that doesn't feel safe for them. So when we're talking to an individual, it is very individual. It is very much down to that person as a unique being, and not to compare, but there are specific steps that we would go through.
The whole thing about purpose as well, because there's a lot of people in the world that don't know. If you say to them, do you know what your purpose is in life? They're like, well, what? or, you know, what are your passions? Because we're so lost in the treadmill of life and work and looking after people or whatever, that people go, wow, I actually don't know. And I assume, because I've been doing this, been in the world of learning and development for 20 years, I am very open to that. And I forget sometimes, oh God, some people aren't even into self-development or personal growth, or they'll say, that's so American. And I'm like, no, it's not really. It's about you being the best person, the best version of you that you can be while you're on this planet. So purpose is massive, and that we found that in our work, that when we ask people what their purpose is and what their passions are, when they connect to that, that gives them that inner hope and that inner wanting to then live out what their purpose is. And it could be something really simple. And it usually is about you wanting connection with other people and you wanting to serve other people.
Yeah. And as part of our, Claire and I have just finished a clinical trial for our Life Freedom Method, and purpose is part of that process. So we've taken two people from being classified as disabled to no longer disabled. And that went through the whole process that we created, which includes the water, which includes the nutrition, which includes the beliefs, and it includes all of the things. But the last piece that we look at is the purpose piece and the well-being of those individuals. Just by that piece of work, literally went like that. And Australians have got it nailed. The Australians do study on how purpose is really important for well-being. So all of those things together create the holistic approach that Claire and I bring to the corporate world, which is very different to the fruit bowl, to the yoga, to someone coming to give you a neck rub at your desk, which is another one, which is all very lovely, mm-hmm. if that works. But if there's some serious going on underneath, a neck rub might help for 10 minutes, but what we want to do is we want to help on a deeper level.
Yeah, because I think you're right. You know, if a bowl of fruit and a neck massage isn't going to sort out your finances, which might be one of the things that's contributing to your mental health and challenges that you're facing or relationships that you're having. You know, these are good little elements that organisations can provide. But actually what both of you are talking through is getting to understand what some of the root causes are. Now, you've both mentioned other nations, so America, and quite often people think all this wacky stuff comes from there, and Australia doing studies. Is there a challenge in the UK with getting organisations, getting individuals to think differently about their well-being? Because traditionally people have said that British people are quite introvert when it comes to discussing well-being. But at the start, you mentioned that since the pandemic, you felt people are becoming more aware of it.
Absolutely. And as I say, I've been doing this for 20 years, and I definitely think in the last 3 to 4 years, that more people are opening up. We get more people inquiring about coaching and well-being and stuff around mindset and the belief code and work that we do. And it's definitely starting to drip through. If we were based in the US, I feel that we would just be constantly, you know, working over there, because they do sound like they want it, and they're used to having, you know, what you call therapy, or they're used to having a therapist or a coach. And again, I think slowly but surely it is definitely happening more and more in the UK. And it's about, I mean, coaching and therapy are completely two different things. However, what we do, we do elements of both. So coaching is about helping people to find their dreams and to hit a goal or to take action. But along the way to those goals, there'll be things that will stop them. So that's where the counselling or the, you know, the belief code or the NLP or the therapy comes in. And then we help them move beyond that and then go towards what they want to work on, and so that they can live a life of well-being and joy and in flow and be able to handle things that are thrown at them. So definitely it's we're getting more inquiries from the UK now. However, I just feel in the US they're more open to it. But when you look at like stats and stuff on medication that's used in the States and opioids and stuff, they're spending billions over there. So then that's a contradictory into what's going on as well. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Jules, but I definitely feel like we're starting to get more, it's becoming easier for us to speak about it. If this had been 5 years ago, people go, you can't be saying that. You can't be saying that meditation and drinking water can help when you can go to the doctors and the doctor will tell you what's the matter. Mm. You should know, we all know our own body best, but we put our hands into someone else who's a medic, who has really good education. However, they don't know our body individually. So it's about really educating people on understanding their well-being and what their body and mind and heart needs, because it's different for everyone.
I feel that in the corporate world right now, we've got a cost of living crisis going on. And yeah, well-being seems to be a nice to have. Mm-hmm. And so many will see it as just an additional cost rather than looking at doing a full cost benefit analysis and saying, well, actually, if we invest X into our wellness, then it's going to give us a 20% return on capital, which is much better than what we're earning in the stock markets, in the bank, all of the rest of it. It's massive. What else are you going to get from your staff team when you're investing their wellness? Loyalty, commitment, passion, joy. That all comes through in your delivery when you're representing your organization. So it's almost asking the corporates to do a real cost benefit analysis and say, well, actually, yes, okay, well, if you're going to spend X thousands of pounds on wellness, that's going to have an impact. And it's, are you brave enough to do that? You know, are you committed to doing that? Or are you just going to tick boxes and carry on receiving sick notes and having people disgruntled or quiet quitting or all of the things, or coasting?
And one of the challenges, particularly when you're talking about well-being and mental health, is men, because men have traditionally been worse at discussing their mental health, their well-being. They make up the majority of people who take their own lives through suicide. How do we get more men to be open about how they're feeling and how they approach their well-being?
Interestingly, in corporates, it's mostly men that we deal with, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, we were just with two directors on Friday, and we work with them in December, and we have a quarterly meetup with them, and they're so open. So I think it's about men speaking up about their experience so that other men can feel, oh, right, okay, so this is quite normal to feel like this, so we can talk about it. But I do work a lot with men. For some reason, guys that come to us, we work with men and women, work with all genders, so we find it pretty easy for men to open up to us. Like, they'll literally open up in the first time that we speak to them, because it must be that energy that we've got, because obviously there's no judgment. It's all about support, and it's about challenging with a good heart and good intention, because you want them to be able to be challenged and so that they can change. But for me, it would be about men explaining their experience with well-being or with coaching or whatever, and so that other men can say, "Oh, right, okay, I think it will be really useful." I do feel like it's changing. There does seem to be a lot more men speaking up, but it still needs to be ramped up more, needs to be more consistent.
You know what I think as well, Claire? Mm-hmm. If you think about it, when we work with men, they just take the feedback, right? So, for example, we've got, one of the guys that I work with on the clinical trial, I'd say to me, I'm going to make you cry. No, you're not. I've got the emotional intelligence of a teaspoon. I said, who told you that? And it's almost like he'd shut off to emotion because he'd learned that that's not the way that men are. And actually, so I challenged, right, how did you feel in your body when your child was born? What do you mean? How do you feel? How did you feel? Well, proud. Well, where did you feel that? That's a word. Where did you feel that? And almost taking them out of their heads into their body and going, well, where did you feel that? Well, here, I think. And then I go, okay, so that's what feeling is. And we spend so much time in our heads. And it's easy for us to call, easier for us to call men out on, call BS on them. And they won't be offended. Just say, no, I'm sorry, that's absolutely rubbish. Let's rework that, because if you want to get well, if you want to get this done, we need to go deeper. and you haven't got the emotional intelligence of a teaspoon, you have got emotions in there. What you've done is you're numbing them out, because actually dealing with them sometimes can be too big. So explaining that process to them can be quite liberating for men, because they haven't had that outlet.
Yeah.
Because of conditioning. So we find, like, when we have those really open conversations, they're going, oh, all right then. And at first there's some nerves, because obviously they're going to have to be vulnerable. But we're holding space for them, so they're in a really safe place. So, yeah, I think that men are in some ways easier, because we work with a lot of women that we can really offend. We don't do it intentionally.
Not intentionally, but...
They could be like, oh, and then it takes them a while to get work through something, whereas men can be a little bit more matter of fact about it once they get in charge and in touch with those emotions.
Now, you mentioned a couple of times the words emotional intelligence when you were talking through that example. What do you mean by emotional intelligence?
First protocol, I mean, I know this from teaching in corporate. We used to do a lot of it, and we used to include it in leadership development. So it was all about the first protocol with emotional intelligence is, how self-aware are you? So what are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What thoughts are you thinking? How do they make you feel? How does that affect your day? So it's about, for me, this is where I love meditation and yoga, because it, and there's loads of other things that can bring you to that present moment, but breath work, just being still and just really being aware of, what am I thinking? How's that thought making me feel? And how's that going to affect me right now? Or how's that going to affect the actions that I take today? So if I'm having a bad thought, okay, well, I'm going to have probably a pretty crap day. If I'm having a good thought, then probably going to feel better about it, and I'm going to follow out and look for the good things in the day. So that self-awareness piece has got to be key. Noticing how you feel, but also noticing how you show up in your day. So if you are a leader, whether that's of a family or in a business or in a community, understanding how, what you, your thoughts are and feelings are in the moment, and how that's going to affect everybody else, that is first. And also knowing what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, so that you can't do everything. You cannot be good at everything. So you don't need to try. And then understand who in your family or who on your team has got the skills that you haven't got. And then you can delegate those tasks to them, or delegate that work to them. So self-awareness is key. If you're not self-aware and you don't know what your strengths, your weaknesses are, what your thoughts or what your feelings are, then you don't know anything. So you've got to be self-aware first. That's the first protocol. Then there's got to be the self-discipline. So really managing how you show up in your day, and whether you want to, you know, get angry with someone, or whether you want to choose to be calm. It's that whole, how do I operate with this customer or this team member? Self-discipline. Okay. Finding a way to go and count to 10 for 10 to the 10, and then come back and deal with the situation. And then you've got the social side of emotional intelligence. So how are you in social situations and in creating relationships? The next protocol is self-motivation. What motivates you, and how, you know, what do you want to do in life? And making sure that you do things that motivate you as well. And there's another one, there's a fifth element of emotional intelligence, and it slipped my mind.
But all of that stuff that you've talked about is almost like the traditional way of teaching it, right? And so what we do now is bring in human design into that, to bring it down to the actual individual level. Because the human design talks about, it sounds very woo, but there's a lot of science behind it. It talks about the spirit of the aura and about that presence. So, you know, when you, there's certain people that walk into the room and you just know that they're there, because they've got that
energy.
Presence, and they've got that energy. And there's also those mood hoovers that walk in, and you can feel them as well. And it's having that understanding of your own presence, how your energy affects other people, both negatively and positively, is massively important. And the way that we will teach that is by combining all of the traditional stuff that Claire's just talked about, but then introducing this, the new concept of, it's not that new, but it's newer than a lot of the profiling things that are out there, is almost explaining why they are the way that they are, and that's okay, and understanding where conditioning has taken place and where they are here to shine. Because if they know where they're here to shine, then they can be lit up and they can bring out a level of energy that is going to support everybody.
And that's a brilliant tool, isn't it, for the whole self-awareness, you know, like other personality profiles like Myers-Briggs, DISC or Insight. They are brilliant tools for helping people with their own self-awareness and emotional intelligence. But human design goes so much deeper. So it's like giving yourself a permission slip to be that person that you are. So since I found out what I was as a generator, and the in-depth I know about myself, I've changed even in the last couple of years, and I've let stuff go, and I've said no to things that I don't want to do anymore. And that gives me more space and freedom to live a life of balance and joy. And then more of the good stuff comes in because I'm open for it.
And even the last couple of months, right?
Yeah.
We challenge each other to make sure that we live in as close to our design as possible. So if Claire says, oh, I've been asked to do this, I'll say, well, does it light you up? And she'll say, well, no, I said, well, we're not doing it then. So it's almost having that level of discipline to work with the way that we're meant to be here to interact with the world. And if it doesn't light us up, we're not doing it. And we literally, even every day we learn something new, every day we bring something different to the table, because we are, it's a different thing knowing your human design. And there's another thing embodying it. And that embodiment creates so much change and so much freedom, actually, mm-hmm. and understanding. And yeah, you can release so much that you've potentially been carrying for, well, for me, nearly 53 years, for Claire, 40 odd years. So
it's a whole people-pleaser thing, because we're conditioned to, well, a lot of us are, and it's like, oh, I should do this, and I should do this for them. And it's like, you know what? No, you don't have to.
That's not just about work, is it? Because actually what you're talking about is life in general. So, you know, some of those things that you've just mentioned there about you not wanting to do something because it doesn't light you up from a work perspective. But I guess you could apply that to your life in general. If getting up for a run every morning is because you think you've got to do it, but it doesn't light you up, then don't do it. Find something different.
Completely. And it's a whole life thing. Yeah.
We've got a lady in our membership, and she was like more or less given a role to go for. It was like the next level up. And so she was like, I don't know whether to take it. And we were like, oh, so I think we teach, you know, because we're teaching human design in the membership. And in the end, she said, I'm not going for it, because it doesn't give me joy. And she said, I'm so glad I've made that decision. And we were quite surprised, because we thought she was just naturally going to go for it. And she was like, no, I'm not doing it. And she said, I'm so glad.
She got the job.
She said no. And she was like, no. And it's left space now for other stuff to come in for her. So she said,
she got her power, didn't she?
Really good about it. But she would have just took it if she hadn't had this education in the last 6 months. She said, I just would have said yes, because it's the next step, whether it gives me joy or not, it's just the next thing. And she's not talking.
Fantastic. There's so much more that I could talk to you both about. I found our conversation today really inspiring, and just hearing, you know, some of the stuff that you're doing to support, in particular, I know the work that you're doing with the NHS and with people focused very much on their kind of physical well-being as well. If you had to give one piece of advice to an individual and one piece of advice to an employer, we'll start with you, Claire. What would you say to an individual that's starting to feel burnt out, that's perhaps listening to this podcast thinking, I don't know what to do? What would you say to them?
Ask them to stop and be still and just sit with themselves for 10 minutes and just really listen to their body and what it's telling them. And if not, tune in to our free resources, what we have. But I would just ask them to stop, be still, and think about what brings them joy.
That's exactly what I would say.
Yeah, and for employers, you're only as resilient as your workforce. So if you've not got a resilient workforce, you're not going to have a resilient business. It's because the business is run by people. So look after your people, and the business will look after itself and it's performing.
And Jules, you mentioned earlier that with the cost of living crisis, that some companies might be thinking of this as just an expense, when actually earlier in this podcast, you've talked about all the value of companies investing and making sure that the well-being of their teams is looked after. What would you say to any organisation, any HR director, HR manager, L&D professionals listening, thinking, yeah, that's going to be a difficult sell to the business?
It might be a difficult sell to the business, but if you think back to each and every employee within your business right now is going to be affected by that cost of living crisis. So at this time that as a nation we're going through this, if you have got the funds within your business to invest in your people, now is the time that they need it. Now is the time that they're struggling. Now is the time that they're worried about feeding their kids. Now is the time about paying their mortgage, which if they're on an interest only, because that's the only way they could afford to do it, that is now climbing up. That is going to impact on their presence and their performance while they're actually at work.
Lovely. Thank you both so much for joining us on this podcast today. It's been a genuine pleasure to speak to both of you, and we'll make a link to your site available so anyone that's listening can access all of your content. So Jules, Claire, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
For more of our podcasts, visit our website at podcast.tedlearning.co.uk, or you can find us on most podcast platforms.